What is happening, gang? We have got an awesome show for you today on the Inside Football Podcast with Bill Polian. In today's episode, we're going to do something you guys have been clamoring for, and it's a little different on the pod. We're going to spend the next few weeks looking at the 2020 season, because in Bill's opinion, after about 6 weeks, that's when you get your first kind of sense of how a team is actually performing from an analytics standpoint. You have enough data to kind of do a deep dive. So get ready. This is going to be like nothing you've probably heard in terms of media assessments of the NFL. This is not a fantasy breakdown. This is not a media assessment. This is truly an analytics-based assessment of where the teams in the AFC are, how they rank, who's doing well, who's not doing well, who can we kind of count on to be the lead dogs in the AFC moving forward, and who are some of the good teams, the teams with good records, that we might want to go, hey, hold on a second, they might not be there yet. So sit back, relax, and get ready. This is a modern take on the NFL. This is the AFC in 2020 thus far, and this is the Inside Football Podcast with Bill Polian. My lamp is lit. How about you guys?
My lamp is lit.
My lamp is illuminated.
All right. Well, Rick put it in the script for today, and I feel like anytime it's written, you got to do this. So, all right. We have got something I have always wanted to do in my life. This is going to be a little different today on the podcast, and I apologize in advance for the level of enthusiasm that I personally have going into this show. It is not every day that you get to pick the brain of one of the greatest minds in the history of the NFL about what's going on currently in the league. And kind of dive into what's actually happening, not in the way that the media sees it, not in the way fantasy analysts see it, but in the way that people in the building actually see a season evolve. And so we're going to get a special look today through the eyes of an advanced scout and GM in the legendary Hall of Famer himself, Bill Polian, about what's happening in the league today. So without any further ado, Rick, why don't you kick us in to this awesome episode?
Absolutely. So, folks, once you've heard these episodes, I can't guarantee you a front office job in the NFL, but you will absolutely have a new, more informed, more sophisticated view of how teams game plan, how they view the opposition, how they put their attack and their defense together. So here's a little preview of what we're about to do. It starts with three key aspects of the game that a scout's analyzing when he's watching the play of the upcoming opponent. And Bill is going to tell us right now about the first phrase in a way that only a Bill Polian can. So, Bill, the first of the three phases that we're going to talk about.
Well, the first of the three phases is scheme. But really what this is all about is how you apply certain analytics to analyzing a team and how it points you in the right direction in terms of bringing up questions, providing answers to how to attack them, answers how to defend them, etc. So let's start with the metrics. These are tried and true. In order to win in the National Football League, as an offense, you need to score 23 or more points a game. As a defense, you'd like to hold the opposition to 20 or less. You would like, in an ideal world, to throw for 250 yards passing. And in an ideal world, you'd like to rush for 100 yards, which would mean 350 total yards in a ball game. The turnover margin, you want to be positive. And the quarterback rating, which is a measurement of how your quarterback is doing in various number of categories, should be 100 or better. So with those benchmarks in mind, now let's look at some systems of football, some schemes. And we're doing the AFC today, and we'll do the NFC next week. So I had to do a little more work on this than I ordinarily would if I were an advanced scout, because I'd only be preparing for one team and not analyzing eight. So for the purposes of this discussion, I haven't gone into the depth that I typically would if it were only looking at one team. But this is a demonstration project for your benefit, listeners. So we're not going to make it high math. All right. There's any number of systems of football. You got the West Coast offense. You got the Kansas City version, which is a wide open West Coast offense. You got multiple formation run-oriented attacks, which is what Pittsburgh runs. You have a power offense, which is what Baltimore runs. You have a multifaceted passing game tied to a power offense, which is what Tennessee runs. And you've got a multiple offense, which would, you know, almost all run and pass equally, which Buffalo runs. So that's what they'd like to get. Raiders are West Coast. New England this year is power run because of Cam and no Brady. Miami is an old-fashioned three-wide semi-spread offense, not dissimilar to what we did in Indianapolis. And Indy now is basically in the same offense that we ran when Peyton was there, at least from a scheme system. So with those metrics in mind, let's take a look at what each of these teams are doing. Now, some teams have played seven games, some have played six. Six is the minimum number you can have for statistics to be relevant. Everything other than that is a small sample size. So, too small a sample size, excuse me. So, when we get, this is not a really clear picture. You'll get some picture from it. It'll be a little bit cloudy. When we get to week 12, when everybody's finished with their buys and everybody has played 11 games, we'll revisit this and you'll have a much clearer picture than we do now of what the teams are, for two reasons. Number one, we'll have a much larger sample size. Number two, injuries, key injuries will have washed themselves through the clubs, and you'll know, for example, that Dak Prescott isn't going to be there. You'll see a true Cowboy picture without Dak Prescott there. So having laid out all those predicates, let's look at offensive and defensive systems.
Bill, before you start, one question. Talk about whether most coaches come in where they have the scheme and try to make the personnel fit that, or do they have a look at the personnel and say, this is the scheme we're going to run, or is it a mixture of both, and what's the optimal way to do that?
It's a mixture of both, and that's the optimal way to do it, is a mixture. And in the end, the game, pro football is about players. College football is about systems. Pro football is about players. And so in the end, if you're going to last a long time in pro football as a coach, you have to adapt your system to the players that you have, not the other way around.
Okay.
And you'll see examples of that, by the way. So, okay, let's start with Kansas City. Andy Reid is a West Coast offense disciple, but he has gravitated to a more wide-open 53-and-a-third-yard wide approach because of the talent that he has and because he can utilize that talent best in a wide-open attack. So he's what I'm calling West Coast wide open multiple. And here are the key players. Here are the game breakers he has on offense. Tyreek Hill, Kelce, Mahomes, Hilaire. Triplets and the best quarterback in football. So that's an ideal position to be in. They are averaging 276 yards passing per game, 140 yards running per game, for a total of 416 total yards per game on average. That's off the charts. That's as good as it gets. And they're plus five in the turnover ratio. I'm not going to mess with quarterback ratings right now because we'll get to them at a later time. Mm-hmm. All right, let's look at Pittsburgh. This is a multiple offense, but in the end, it's run-oriented. And, let me back up. Kansas City's defense is a 4-3 multiple. They do a fair amount of blitzing. It's not Blitzburg. They're not a heavy blitzing team, but they do more than average. They have game breakers. Actually, three if you count the rush end, but I'm not counting him because I don't know if he's healthy right now. Jones and the Honey Badger. They're giving up 21 points a game. So their point differential between what the offense scores and what the defense gives up is plus eight. That's the reason they're 5-1. Pure and simple. Let's turn to Pittsburgh. As I said, multiple formation, going to be run-oriented whenever possible. They have Big Ben. They have Juju. They have James Conner. They have Snell, two really good running backs. They have Chase Claypool, a rookie who's come into his own. And they are averaging 221 yards passing and 137 yards rushing, which is 358, which is a little surprising because it's only, on average, eight more than you'd like for the optimum. But they're plus five in the turnover margin. And here's where point differential comes into play. They're a 3-4 zone Blitzburg, just as they always have been, all the way back to the Bill Cowher years. Mm-hmm. They have Watt, they have Haywood, they have Dupree, they have Edmonds, they have Fitzpatrick. So they got five game changers on defense. They had six before Bush got hurt. And they are giving up 18.8 yards a game, points a game, excuse me, rounded up to 19. So they're plus 11 in point differential. Positive plus five turnovers, plus 11 point differential, record of 6-0. Baltimore, power run team. They have Lamar Alexander, they have Ingram, they have Dobbins, they have...
Lamar Jackson,
excuse me. I keep confusing Lamar with this senator from
Tennessee.
It's a common screw up. People do it all the time.
And neither were able to succeed in becoming president of the United States when they ran. So
true.
There's still time.
They have Brown, and they have Andrews on offense. Five game breakers. And they are averaging a whopping 170 yards rushing and 164 yards passing. Their total is 342, and they're plus six in turnovers. So let's stop right here and say they're not hitting their number on offense, mm-hmm. and the hole is in the passing game. They're well below what they need to be. And so if they're going to finish on a high note and go a long way in the playoffs, which they should, that's going to have to improve. So if I'm sitting here getting ready to play the Baltimore Ravens, I'm saying to myself, I got a chance here to minimize their passing, and if I can prevent big plays in the run game, I got a chance to win the game. There, as I said, 3-4 blitz. That it's Rex Ryan blitz, which means it's crazier than Blitzberg, more exotic. They have Campbell, they have Judon, they have Peters, they have Humphrey, so they got four game breakers on defense. And most importantly, in the Rex Ryan scheme, two corners, two shutdown corners. They're giving up 17 points a game, and they're plus 13 because they're averaging 30 points a game. They're plus 13 in the margin, in scoring margin. But beware a little bit, not a lot, but a little bit, of 178 in the passing game, because you may have heard astute analysts, of which there are not many, but you may have heard astute analysts say, I wonder what happens to Baltimore when they have to come from behind and get chunk plays out of the passing game. That's a valid point.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Bill, really quick, to that point, is Hollywood the type of player you can scheme out of a game? Because you would think that's the key to them getting chunk plays in the passing game, you would think, is trying to take the top off the defense with to Hollywood. But that's something, from a defensive standpoint, you can kind of scheme a player like that out of a game, can't you?
Yeah. You can. There are a number of ways to do it. In the old way that New England did it, they would take their shutdown corner and put him on Hollywood. And they'd probably put Patrick Chung on Andrews, and then they'd double off both of those guys, perhaps. And the problem you have is Lamar running the ball, so they present a different scheme problem. But yes, you can take him out, and certainly in 2 minutes you can take him out. The thing is, you got to be careful. To press only with your corners. You can't press all across the field, and you can't press with three corners, because when they turn their backs, Lamar is gone. There's nobody to tackle him. So that's it.
Bill, while you're at that, could you also talk about the, you know, because especially last year when Lamar was just tearing everybody up, and you and I talked about, once he had a year and defenses had seen it, something that was really unusual, although there are more and more quarterbacks like him that have that athleticism. Talk about really the right way to contain somebody like that so he doesn't destroy you, you know, when you're in a certain coverage and he sees a seam and just takes off.
Well, contain is actually the wrong word, because that's the name of a technique that you would use to play defense. But what you need to do to defense him is two things. When he runs the ball, you have to spill him to the sideline. You have to make sure that you always have a player who has his outside arm free, who Lamar cannot outflank. You got to keep spilling him to the sideline. And then when he gets to the sideline, you have to have as many people as you can on him, hitting him, knocking him down. Or if he turns up, you have people running inside out. Buffalo did it. Kansas City did it. That's how they stopped him. San Diego did it in the playoffs last year. Now, that requires certain types of athletes, too. You can't do it with big slugs. But you spill him in the running game, and then here's the hardest part. You have to mush rush. That's an old-fashioned term. What you got to get the rushers. First of all, Rex Ryan says rush five. He's right. You can't create seams. You got to rush five. And You have to cover every blocker. That's called a cover front. You cover every blocker, and you walk the blocker back to Lamar. You create a picket fence that he can't run around, and you keep squeezing and squeezing and squeezing. And you always keep your outside arm free if you're an end, so that you do not allow him to get back outside you. But you have to go. You can never go past his upfield shoulder, and you can never rush pell-mell. The only person who can rush pell-mell is a sixth person who's coming and who's trying to steer him into another rusher. That's the only time you can do it. If you come rushing pell-mell off the corner and go by him on his upfield shoulder, forget about it. He's gone. And none of the big guys inside are going to catch him. Defensive line coaches don't like to coach that. Defensive linemen don't like to play it. They want to come, especially ends and linebackers, they want to come flying off the edge and knock the living daylights out of the quarterback. You can't do it with Lamar. You can't do it, period. Mm-hmm. You can't do it with Kyler Murray, and you can't do it with Russ.
But even to that point, Bill, and looking at the stats, I mean, one thing that was interesting looking at Lamar is his completion percentage when kept clean is 66.1%, which puts him towards the middle back part of the league in terms of completion percentage when there isn't a rush, a hurry, or a pressure. So in some sort of odd way, if you can just keep him upright in the pocket and not moving, not kind of, you know, killing you with the run, you've got a better chance than trying to blitz him or put him under pressure.
Yeah, absolutely right.
And the stats bear it out.
Pressure isn't pressure. He escapes it. You can't give him an escape route. You just gotta keep put him in the box. Put him in the box. Now he's taller than Kyler Murray and Russ, and so it's easier for him to throw over that box, but you still gotta keep him in the box. You can't let him out. And when you rush pell mell, unless it's somebody who's steering him, they're trying to force him to move in a certain direction.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
He's just going to make you miss. So he's unique. But you know, even though that passing game is not where you want it to be by a pretty wide margin in terms of gross yards, the point differential is such that they're going to handle most people. It's only going to be really good teams like Kansas City that can play with them. Because as we'll see later on, they pound the ball at a clip that's second to none in the league. Let's turn to Tennessee. This is, again, a power run team with a multiple receiver passing game. They have A.J. Brown, they have Davis, they have Tannehill, and of course they have Henry. They're averaging 265 yards passing, which is, Tannehill's doing a heck of a job. 158 rushing, which of course is almost all Henry. They're plus six in turnovers, and they're averaging 423 yards a game, which is darn good. And they're averaging 33 points a game, which is darn good. Their defense is another story. They're a 3-4 New England-style defense, so it's multiple fronts, multiple coverages. But really, only Landry is their only good rusher. The kid they picked up from Washington is not doing a lot. Jackson is pretty good on the inside. Butler and Baird are great in the secondary. But they're giving up 25 points a game. And their point differential is plus eight. So what you saw on Sunday against Pittsburgh, when you saw a very effective offense versus a somewhat ineffective defense, you saw what occurred in the first half, darn near a blowout. And then, surprisingly, Big Ben took the second half off or wasn't concentrating or something, because it was looking like it was going to be a horrendous blowout. Now, they did, to their credit, they fought back. Tennessee did, and Pittsburgh ended up stealing it at the end. But the potential there in that matchup, which we'll get to in a second, is pretty good for Pittsburgh.
I think Roethlisberger took it off because he knew when the CBS feeds went down, nobody was going to watch the game anyway.
I have a serious question. Bill, is there anything to the fact that there are some teams that seem to do this thing where they have, where they, for whatever reason, fall behind significantly, but really have the capacity to come back and make a game of it, not just once, but with some, regularity during the season? Is there a reason that one kind of a team does that more than others?
Yeah, it has to do with personnel. Why does Kansas City do it? They got Tyreek Hill, they got Kelsey, they got Mahomes, they got Hilaire. That's why they do it, because they can overmatch you.
Right. But why Tennessee seems to fall behind and be able to work their way back into games. I mean, is that anecdotal, or could that be something inherent in the makeup of the squad or their schemes?
Yeah, because they can bang with Henry. And Henry gets more chunk plays in the run game than almost anybody. So, he bangs away and keeps the ball, keeps the other team's offense on the bench, and they have a good enough passing game now with the development of Brown and Davis, and Tannehill is a good enough quarterback that once they get that running game going, then they can get chunk plays. So they can come back on you. If they don't have Tannehill, they can't do it.
Right, and it's interesting because Henry, strength, speed, but not. I don't think a lot of a void, does he? He doesn't really.
No, he doesn't. No, but that, it doesn't matter because he's a freight train. Mm-hmm. He's a blaster.
The other thing that I think was clear in that game is how much special teams matter. Because Tennessee, from a special teams perspective, Gostkowski aside, they do not seem like a strong part of the AFC on teams, whereas Pittsburgh, they seem to have teams pretty well locked down with Danny.
Well, actually, Kern's pretty good, their punter. I didn't do a special teams matchup. It's a totally different deal. But special teams are always, in close games, are always the deciding factor. Mm-hmm. And, it's the old story, kickers win championships. Now, if you're a lousy team, it doesn't matter who the kicker is. If you're a good team, it matters a lot.
Yeah, I'll throw in a word for the Ravens on that front. Both the quality of the special teams and their kicker and their punter have pulled them through a lot of situations over the years.
Yeah, they're both excellent. They're both excellent. We'll do that next. We'll do that analysis next time around.
Yep.
Okay, let's take a look at Buffalo. This is a multiple offense with an athletic quarterback, but he's different than the other three. The other three have phenomenal avoid. Lamar has phenomenal avoid. He breaks, and as the saying goes, he breaks defenders' ankles. Allen doesn't have that. He's a long striding, fast, explosive runner. But because he doesn't have a lot of avoid, he gets in a lot of car crashes. And we've seen him injured a fair amount. Fortunately, this year, not a lot. But he's a different style runner. So you got to be. Now, he's harder to tackle than the little guys because he's bigger and stronger. But all things being equal, I'd rather the guys with the super avoid. That's my own bias. Okay. He's a big part of the offense. They have Diggs this year, and he's married to Diggs. Boy, they have developed a chemistry that's out of this world. Beasley quietly is the second receiver. So if you're getting ready for the Bills and you look at the statistics, who's making the catches, who's averaging, we're going to get into it in a little bit, who's averaging the right number of yards per pass attempt, Beasley is the guy, along with Diggs. They haven't established a third receiver yet. Brown's been in and out of the lineup with injuries, but they haven't established a third yet, and they haven't established a tight end yet. Singletary is a good little runner. They do not have a second back who can carry the load, and that is a problem. So if we look at the numbers, 277 passing yards a game, not bad. 92 run, not good enough. We're not hitting the 100 measure. And we've got a minus two in turnovers, which is really a problem. You don't want to be in the minus category in turnovers, because your chances of making the playoffs or advancing with a minus turnover ratio are slim to none. Okay, they are a 4-3 one gap upfield rush team. Their front is really not performing. They have Oliver, who's a good player, but he's a little on the light side. Jerry Hughes, who's a good player, a little on the light side and getting older. Edmonds is a really good linebacker, but he's been hurt. Milano's a really good linebacker, and he's been hurt. And Tre'Davious White is a terrific corner. And so of their difference makers, only three have been on the field. Edmonds has been bothered by the injury, and Milano hasn't even been out there. So Buffalo is averaging 26 points a game, which is okay. That's fine. But they're giving up 27. So they're minus two in turnovers, minus one in point differential. If you're a Buffalo Bills fan, take a deep breath, because this could be not quite the year you thought you were going to have. The numbers are telling you, beware. Beware. Okay, let's go to some others. Systems. Raiders, West Coast, Gruden system. Highly verbose. Really efficient in the passing game. 3-2 record. Carr, Ruggs, Waller, Jacobs, game changers. Averaging 30 points a game, 278 yards passing, 121 rushing. They hit both benchmarks, 399. Minus four in turnover ratio. Not good. Defense, 4-3, power 4-3 multiple. Really only Crosby and Abram are difference makers. Ferrell can rush inside, but he's not quite there yet. We could include him in there and say, well, as an inside rusher, he's okay. But they're giving up 30 points a game. So they're scoring 30, giving up 30, minus four in turnovers. Watch out. Beware.
Bill, let me ask you something about turnovers. How much of that is legitimately attributable to coaching, either, being on guys to protect the ball, when you're on offense to, not do this one hand stuff, to switch arms, one from the other side of the tackler, and to ball hawk on defense and have a second guy come in and try and punch out? I mean, is it just who you happen to have on your team and your athletic ability, or is that something that really can be created by good coaching, teaching good technique?
Everybody teaches good technique and everybody coaches well. There are players who are careless with the ball, and at least when I was working, they didn't stay around very long. I learned that from Coach Levy, who simply hated fumblers. There are turnovers that you can't avoid, where, you know, somebody makes a great play or somebody makes a weird occurrence takes place, you know, you'll get 1 in 7, 1 in 8 like that, you know, are like that, generally speaking. Passing game turnovers, some are on the receivers when they run, they don't run the right route. Others are on the receivers because they don't catch the ball. Most are on the quarterback because he throws it where he shouldn't throw it. Doesn't read the defense correctly. Now, in a -4 situation here, the Raiders can probably coach their way out of this. You'll see some other teams where there's no chance. And, you know, just...
Well, because also with the Raiders, I mean, Derek Carr has been somewhat protective of the football in that he only has 2 interceptions on the season. So you got to wonder if some of this being so significantly sort of deficient in the fumbling category, if that's... Is that an easier thing to fix?
Yeah, fumbling is easier to fix, yes. And Derek Carr has worked very hard to limit the interceptions. He's worked very hard at that, and John's worked with him to make sure that that isn't happening. And by the way, the number, if it's a negative number, it doesn't matter how it occurred. It's still a negative number. And it still has a huge effect, as we'll show you later on. Okay, New England. This is a power run team with Cam. They have Cam. They have Edelman. They have Michelle, who is hurt. And they're not doing much on offense. The proof of the pudding is that they've got 207 yards passing on average. That's unheard of with the New England Patriots. Hadn't been that way since, I guess, Tom was a rookie. They're averaging 167 in the run game. So, as usual, Bill Belichick finds ways to win. They're 374 total. They're averaging 22 points a game. They're zero. They're even in turnovers, in turnover margin. Their defense is 3-4 multiple. It's Belichick defense. You know, you don't know what you're going to get from week to week. They have... Guy is a good player. Winovich is a good rusher. Gilmore and McCourty are good players in the secondary. We know they've lost a lot of guys because of both free agency and opting out. And they're giving up 22 points a game. So they're zero in point differential. But in 2 and 3 in 5 games. So... the bottom line is they're not getting the job done in a passing game. And, you know, how do you clean that up? We'll see. Bill has to find a way.
So, Bill, I noticed that Edelman, his yards per catch is actually up this year a little bit. Are they trying to fix that by having him run deeper patterns, or is he just on his own getting more yards after the catch?
No, he's getting more yards after the catch. He's getting more yards after the catch.
Okay.
Simply because Cam is a guy that likes to throw the ball over the middle. And so if he hits him in stride, he can go. And people are not defending them the way they used to with combinations inside. Because Cam presents a different problem offensively. Okay, Miami, interesting here.
Hey, Bill, sorry, one more question on New England.
Yeah.
In a weird way, is the Sony Michel injury kind of the biggest loss? Because I know you've kind of hammered it into my head, the yard per attempt from a running back is such a crucial metric. And, I mean, his yards per attempt were 6.7 yards per attempt before the injury, and the offense did seem to be functioning better. Obviously, you have the issue with Cam, the issue with the passing game, the COVID stuff, but that one's got to be a big one.
Yeah, it is a big loss because he's ideal to run the read option. And that's Cam's bread and butter. So, yes, it's a huge loss. That's the answer. You know, back to the old story, it's not the X's and O's, it's the Johnnies and Joes.
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm.
You know, one guy like that who's a game changer, you lose them, you're nowhere near as functional as you used to be.
Bill, could you explain a little bit in terms of read option? You know, what about what the read is? What is the read? What do you see that makes you know which way to go? What is it? You know, because it's really never explained. We know you got there.
You know. On any option play, what you're doing is optioning a defensive lineman or a linebacker. And when you option him, that means you don't block him. So he's a free rusher. Now you can option the nose tackle in the midline option. You can option the defensive tackle. You can option the defensive end. You can option the outside linebacker. You can even option out to the safety or corner. Baltimore does some of that. So you leave the player who's being optioned wide open. He's not blocked. And the quarterback comes right at him. Everybody else is blocked. And you have a double team somewhere because the unblocked guy is obviously his man is free to do something else.
Right.
The quarterback meshes with the back at some point in the backfield. And the quarterback reads the optioned player. So let's say it's very simple. We're going to option the defensive tackle in a 4-3 on the right-hand side. So the quarterback sticks the ball. Cam Newton sticks the ball in Sony Michel's belly. He rides him toward the line of scrimmage while watching the defensive tackle. If the defensive tackle goes for Sony Michel to tackle him, Cam pulls the ball and runs around the area vacated by the defensive tackle. Same if you're optioning the defensive end. In the old triple option, there was a pitch man. Sometimes there's a pitch man who's on a fly sweep in the read option, even in the NFL. But a lot of the times it's just put the ball in, read the guy who's being optioned, that's predetermined, and then either keep or give. Very straightforward.
Okay.
The most difficult play for a defense, if you want big yardage, is when you option the end man on the line of scrimmage. Because now the quarterback has room to maneuver. That guy is in no man's land. He's neither fish nor fowl. The defender is neither fish nor fowl. I've always believed, this goes back to the 1960s, Joe Paterno defense, you better make the quarterback make a decision early. His deal was always turn it into a sweep. Send the option guy right at the quarterback's face mask and make him pitch the ball or get a broken jaw. One of the two. Now that sounds very crass, and you can't quite do that anymore, but you better shake him up. If he's going to run the option, you better make him pay a price. There is a school of thought that says you feather, meaning the defender fakes as though he's coming down and makes the quarterback pitch and then levels and runs down the line of scrimmage and you try to turn the ball carrier back. A lot of times you don't see anything but the ball carrier's rear end and back numbers as he turns up the field for a huge game. I'm not a fan of feathering. But that's the toughest way to do it. If you run the midline option into the middle of the line, you might also be optioning a linebacker if he were coming right at the quarterback or at the mesh point. And that play typically doesn't get big yardage, but it's really good in short yardage situations where you need 3 or 4 yards. I mean, because the ball carrier is going forward 100 miles an hour. Now, the mesh is hard to do because the ball carrier has to expect the ball. The back has to expect the ball. It's all on the quarterback to put it in and take it out.
Right.
Okay, let's turn to Miami. Interesting situation here. 3-wide team, kind of old-fashioned 3-wide offense. They have Fitz, they have Parker, they have Gesicki, all having good years, averaging 27 points a game, 280 yards passing, 105 rushing. Not great, but good enough. 355 a game, plus 2 in the turnover ratio. Chan Gailey's done a nice job with this offense. Now, they apparently feel like it's time to put Tua in there, so these numbers may change because this is all Fitz, who can run the offense quite well. Now, what Fitz can't do is run around anymore, and he does have the interception gene, but Tua's going to be in there, so we'll see what he can do. Their defense is a 3-4 New England multiple, because that's where their coach came from. He came from the Pat staff. So they have Lawson, they have Van Noy, they have McMillan, they have Jones, they have McCain. Those are really good defensive players. They're giving up 19 points a game. They're a very solid defense. They're plus 8 in turnover margin. Hence, and their record is 3-3, hence a little bit of the consternation about taking Fitz out of the lineup, because I don't know if they'll be as efficient with Tua in there. But they clearly, Tua's the guy of the future, and they want to get him the work. So this is a question mark team going forward. Big question mark, because you don't know what Tua will do. Indianapolis, same as Miami. 3 wides, multiple passing game, 1 back running game. They have Phillip Rivers. They have T.Y. Hilton. They have Jack Doyle, but the rest of their receiving core is decimated. So that's a real problem. They're averaging 26 points a game because they are pretty explosive. Mac, their running back, is gone for the season too, so they're playing the rookie from Wisconsin in there. They're averaging 265 yards a game passing, 98 rushing, just two off the number, but still worrisome. 363 total, which is good, plus 3, which is good. They play Tampa 2 defense. They have a bunch of good defenders: Buckner, Teray, Houston, Leonard. They're giving up 19 points a game, and so that's a plus 7 turnover margin, which is scoring margin, which means gives them that 4-2 record. So you look at all of these systems. You can see some statistically, like Kansas City, that knocks your eyes out, where both sides of the ball are playing well. There are others like Tennessee, where one side of the ball is playing well and the other isn't. There are teams like Buffalo, where you worry about, do they have enough run? Do they have enough defense? And usually, when you have 2 deficiencies, let's take Buffalo as an example, not being able to run the ball well enough and not being able to keep those points down under 22, that's worrisome. Now, is the division good? No, it's not. So, you know, they're probably in pretty good shape there. But you worry a little bit about a team like that. You worry a lot about a team like New England that's one-dimensional. You worry about a team like the Raiders. I mean, you're not going to win anything giving up 30 points a game. So when there are multiple deficiencies, in the Raiders' case, minus 4 in the turnovers, 30 points a game on defense, you worry about that. So those are teams that need to improve if they're going to be factors come December. Okay. Any more questions on that? That's the scheme point of view.
Yeah, let me just ask, in a typical year, you know, when you just well established the two or more deficiency among those certain keys in the scheme with the schemes, how many teams are there that are really above the fray, where they're either at just one or maybe zero deficiencies, you know, and you know that they are headed for the playoffs and maybe the Super Bowl, or at least obviously not every, but possibly the Super Bowl. How many teams like that are there a year, or does in a typical year are there none or only one?
Oh no, there are plenty. There are plenty. I'll give them to you right now. And I'm going to add the quarterback. Rating to it, which will give you a much much clearer picture. Kansas City, they're hitting every benchmark, and the quarterback rating's 110. Houston's 1-5. They're down in the bottom, and we'll talk about them later. They're hitting only the passing benchmarks. Their quarterback rating is 105. Everything else is abysmal. And they're -3 in the turnover, and they're 86 yards rushing. So see you later, alligator.
Right.
Buffalo, we talked about. The defense is a concern. Passer rating 108, which is okay, that's fine, but we got to clean up the other stuff. Indy 4-2, 26 points on offense, plus 7 point differential, 363 total yards, plus 3 in a turnover ratio, 93 for the quarterback. Uh-oh.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to ask you about that.
Now, one of those is likely to some of that's likely due to the injury to the receivers. But it's a concern. Here's the biggest outlier of all: Cleveland, 4-2, averaging 27 points a game. On defense, giving up 31. Okay, -4 in point differential, 189 yards in the passing game with those receivers, 170 yards rushing because they got probably two of the top three backs in the league. So they're just barely over the number at 359. And they're +4 in the turnover ratio, but the quarterback's rating is 84.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and their offensive line is playing arguably as well as any offensive line in the league. You don't think so?
No. But it's not terrible. It's not terrible. It's not. Let me put it this way. It's better than it was. It's better than it was. To answer your question,
yeah,
Kansas City's for real.
Mm-hmm.
Baltimore's for real. Pittsburgh's for real.
Okay.
All the others have at least one worrisome deficiency.
Mm-hmm. So, in a typical year within, let's say, the AFC, 3 to 4 that you know,
yeah,
they're going to be, you know, which if your fans are lucky, it'll divide up, you know, one per division. So
yeah, that's about right.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and then you get into the persona of players versus the reality, where, you know, Baker's it may be a superstar in commercials, but, you know, and he had a look, and he won one Sunday, but come on, right? 84. That speaks for itself, doesn't it? I mean, come on.
It does. To a general manager or an advanced scout, persona means nothing. It doesn't exist.
Yeah.
It truly doesn't. It, you don't pay any attention to it unless the guy's disruptive. You know, the other stuff, that's, you know, they can talk about that on the morning shows until the cows come home. It doesn't mean anything to people who are analyzing.
But also, not to harp on my offensive line, the Cleveland offensive line point, he's also been kept as clean as any quarterback in the league this year.
He has, for two reasons. Number one, they got a great running back, running game. Both running backs are outstanding. And second of all, you know, the play-action game is just dynamite. Because of that, he should be clean. He should have good looks. And now they've lost Beckham, but my God, what, you know, Landry and Beckham? Come on.
Yeah. But that's also got to be even more alarming when you have a great running game, you're kept clean, you have that level of talent, and you're not putting up numbers that you should be putting up. I mean, that's got to be even more alarming.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Now, let's go. We'll take one other trip through the numbers here for Rick's point of view. Yards, average yards per pass play, you want 7.5 or better. Average yards per rush, if you're going to be legit, you want 4.5 or better. You want to be 45% or better on third down, and you want to be 60% or better in the red zone. And the red zone numbers I have must be outliers, so I'm going to not even worry about that because they're all so high. I think that either I got the wrong numbers or they're outliers. So let's worry about yards per pass, yards per rush, third down. Okay. Houston, 8.4 yards per pass, 3.7 per rush, 41.8 on third down. See you later, alligator. Las Vegas, 8.0 per pass, 3.9 per rush, third down, 52.3. Okay. Not bad on third down, not good enough in the run game, despite the fact that they have the big blaster from Alabama. Indy, 7.9 yards per pass, 3.6 per rush, 39.9 on third down. Fair to middling, you know, not really the kind of rushing performance that you need to be good. Chargers, 7.8 per pass. That's pretty good because the young kid's playing well. 3.9 per rush, 45.4 on third down. Not bad. Tennessee, 7.7.
Hey, Bill. Bill. Sorry, one quick thing on Herbert. If you took, this is the data analytics nerd in me, if you took Tyrod out of the team number, you know, Tyrod's yards per attempt was 6.9. Herbert's at 8.4. I mean, he's got to be playing as well as any rookie in this scenario maybe has ever played in the league through six games.
Well, okay, let's, you know, we've done the schemes and we've done the matchup numbers. Let's go to how the players are playing. Here's the quarterback ratings. I got this broken down by. Let me go to my AFC. Okay. Mahomes 110. Allen 108. Houston 108, huge outlier. Indy 93, Cleveland 84, ugh. Tennessee 114, very good. Jacksonville 94, Cincinnati 85. And here's where we make the comparison. The Chargers 107. Who's getting all the ink and all the TV time?
Rick?
Joe Burrow.
Yeah, Joe Burrow. Well, yes.
Well, and Joe Burrow and Baker. And Tua has gotten more airtime not playing, story-wise, obviously because of the controversy and sitting on the field.
Right.
And it makes for a good TV production. But Herbert is lighting the world on fire at some level, and we're getting nothing in a major media market.
Exactly.
So it shows you that some of this stuff is, as Bill said, it's predetermined. I mean, Burrow's the number one pick. Baker's this, you know, supposed the number one pick the year before. You know, Tua. So I mean, those are the guys that are going to get the ink, no matter what happens, one way or the other. So
yeah, until they fall out of relevancy.
Hey, Bill, to that point in terms of statistical outliers, how insane is it the statistical season Deshaun Watson is putting up, and yet, you know, the team sits here at 1-5, 1-6, you know, obviously deficient in the running game, deficient in turnover, deficient on defense at some level, but it's got to be pretty unusual for a quarterback to be statistically playing this well and have a record that's that poor this early in the season. And part of it, I know I've said this before on the pod, but they didn't get any favors from the league office in terms of who they've had to play out of the gate.
No, they didn't, and Cleveland did, but it's really a function of no running game. Let me pull them up right here for you, so we got a clear view of it. Their run game, just bear with me. Their run game is averaging 86 yards a game. Their turnover ratio is -3. Mm-hmm. Their defense is equally poor. So their defense isn't good enough. Their running game isn't good enough. And their turnover ratio is poor. So, you know, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
The quarterback happens to be an outlier.
I just also wonder, though, had they played Cleveland's schedule and Cleveland played Houston's schedule, would the records be reversed?
Well, it's hard to know. I mean, you have to play the games. The short answer is, if we were doing this at week 10 and both teams had played 10 games, we could look at the numbers and give you a definitive answer. Mm-hmm. My guess is when you're as bad as they are on defense and as bad as they are on third down and as bad as they are in turnovers and as bad as they are in a running game, those are pretty high mountains to climb.
So this actually helped me, because I was listening to Scott's Houston conspiracy theory for 45 minutes last night. So Scott,
it's not a conspiracy. I don't know. In just looking at league schedules in the build up to this show, that anybody has had a more difficult road to hoe than the Texans have had in a long time. I mean, you open at Kansas City ring night, then you get Baltimore, then you get Pittsburgh. You know, they've had to play Green Bay. I mean, they've had to play, and Tennessee. They played 5 of the 6 best teams in the league to get it going. It's just, and then you look at, you know, who some of their opponents have. You don't often see 6-game stretches where you're going to play 5 playoff teams in six games, 3 of which were on the road.
All right. So Bill's longer-term view will answer that, though, because it will balance out.
I think so, but then this is where it gets interesting, because you wonder, and Bill, this would be an interesting question, and we sort of have a question like this in the audible we'll get to. It's like, at what point for them has the locker room just kind of checked out of the season, because there just isn't anything for them to play for? So then at some level, the statistic element of it gets a little wacky in that regard.
You know, it's interesting. That's an interesting question, but bottom line, you'll get anomalies when that happens, and you know it. I mean, you could see it with your eyes. But surprisingly, when you look at the numbers over the course of a season, they reflect how the team played. I mean, they really do. There's you can believe in them. Let's just look at it. Let's take a statistic here that makes some sense. Turnover ratio. Quarterback rating, right? Just two numbers. Tennessee +6. This answers Rick's question, by the way. Who's for real? Who isn't for real? Tennessee plus 6, 114 QBR. Kansas City plus 6, 110 QBR. 5-1. Tennessee's 5-1. Pittsburgh plus 5, 109 QBR. 6-0. Baltimore plus 6, 99 quarterback rating. 5-1. Cleveland plus 4, 84 quarterback rating. 4-2. Now we know that's likely the reverse of Houston. They played a relatively easy schedule, so some of that may be anomalous. But the 84 is real. Indy plus 3, 93, 4-2. Miami plus 2, 95, 3-3. Now we're getting into the mediocre teams, right? New England 0. 82, 2-3. Cincinnati, minus 1, 85, 1-4-1. Jets, minus 2, 80, 0-6. Buffalo, minus 2, 108, 4-2. And so on. So, Tennessee, KC, Pitt, Baltimore are for real. Mm-hmm. Buffalo, Indy, maybe Miami, maybe the Raiders are contenders. And those two numbers tell you all you need to know.
Yeah. But your boy Justin Herbert's, what do you have? I have him a little over 109. What do you have, Matt? Scott?
Yeah, Herbert's at 108. So, I mean.
Well, I got him at 107, but that's okay.
Okay, we're all. So somewhere in there, yeah.
So, yeah.
Totally good. It could be my Chris Collinsworth pro football fantasy or pro football focus statistics are a little odd. But I mean, if you look at the Chargers and you go turnover differential, obviously they're negative in the turnover differential, but strong quarterback rating. You wonder if in the second half of the season, this is what's going to be fun about doing this again in 4 weeks, if that's a team on the come, you know, if they can figure out a couple things on defense, you know, Bill's sleeper pick for the season at running back, you know, has played particularly well. You get the three-headed monster, you got one of the best receivers in the league in Keenan Allen. You wonder if that's a team, you know, at sitting here at 2-4, headed into the second part of the season, if that's a team that can make up some ground.
Maybe. We'll see. I don't know if they have enough defense to do it when it's all said and done. But we'll see.
It doesn't help that Melvin Ingram looked nicked up again this week. But right. That's going to be the fun part about the second half of this season.
Yeah.
Let's turn to players. Mm-hmm. And this is going to tell us who we need to stop in a given game. So, Edwards-Helaire in the running back category, we want 4.5. He's averaging 4.8. Derrick Henry, 4.6.
Hey, Bill, one quick question in terms of Helaire. What kind of impact do you think adding Le'Veon Bell to that roster will make?
Good question.
Don't even think about it. Edwards-Helaire now gets maybe 5 less touches a game, so he's rested over 16, ready for the playoffs.
Kansas City fans can start making their Super Bowl reservations.
I don't know about Super Bowl, but you can be pretty.
I don't think anybody's going.
That's a different prediction. Yeah, that's a different prediction. Oh, that's true.
I don't think that's happening.
That's a good point. Super Bowl parties then, in their homes of 10 or less.
There is hope in Jacksonville. Robinson is averaging 4.5 a carry for a 1-5 team. That's pretty good. Here's why Cleveland has a chance. The duo of Hunt averaging 4.6 and Chubb averaging 5.9.
Yeah.
With those two receivers, well, one is Beckham's gone now, but with Landry, that is dynamite. That's mm-hmm. as good as Helaire and Kansas City's new guy. That's that's really dynamite. So that's why Cleveland has a chance, despite the quarterback not playing great. They have a chance because they run the ball better than anybody. And that's what Coach Stefanski wants. That's the kind of offense that he wants. So their system, despite the quarterback playing poorly, is working for them. Now, defensively, they have to be a lot better because their defense is giving up way too many points. But bottom line, these two are pretty special. James Conner in Pittsburgh, 4.7 a carry. Thanks a lot. And add the kid that backs him up. That's a good combo. You want to know why Cincinnati's not doing well? Mixon, 3.6 a carry. Now, that's an offensive line that would make you sure, you know, put blinders on. Cover your eyes. Jacobs in Las Vegas, interestingly enough, 3.4. That's not, you know, there's more talent there than what he's getting. That if I were this is where advanced scouting is so important. If I were the advanced guy on Las Vegas, I'd want to go back and watch every Jacobs touch and find out what the heck's wrong here. What's going on that he's averaging only 3.4 a carry? Because he's better than that talent-wise. Houston, Johnson, 3.9 a carry. And not good enough. That's kind of an average-sized back who's averaging under 4. Not good enough. Taylor in Indianapolis, 4.1. For a rookie, it's okay, but you'd like it to be better. Gordon in Denver, 4.3. Not good enough for a team that makes a living running the ball. Jackson in Baltimore, here's where the quarterbacks become the outliers, 6.9. That's why they can get by with so few big chunk passing yards, because he's making up for it in the run game.
And Ingram's at 4.5, so.
Yeah. Actually, both backs are at 4.5.
And Gus Edwards is, too. I mean, they've got.
Yes. Gus Edwards is at 4.5, yeah.
They figured out how to run the football in Baltimore.
Yeah.
I think the secret's out.
Yeah. They figured out how to make up for a non-explosive passing game, or a not consistently explosive passing game is a better way to say it.
Exactly.
And that's a good way to do it. I mean, you can how you get those 350 yards is up to you. There's no book that says you got to do it this way or that way. In Gaskin in Miami, 4.1, you know, not really good enough. We talked about Chubb. Gore with the Jets, my Lord, 3.6 at his age, that's incredible, but obviously not good enough. And Newton, 4.9, you would expect Newton to be up in the Jackson category at 6.9, somewhere in there. He's not running the ball the way he used to. And as I mentioned before, Ingram is 4.5, as is the other guy. So
Edwards.
That tells you who you got to stop. It tells you what you have to stop scheme-wise, and it tells you what you have to stop in terms of players who make plays. And that, you know, people say run and stop the run. The teams that are running at a clip of 4.5 or better are 5-1, 5-0, 4-2, 5-0, 4-2, 5-1. If you run, you can win. That's the bottom line. The outlier happens to be the outlier. Who is the outlier here? I just can't. Is Robinson in Jacksonville? Jacksonville's the outlier.
Yeah,
but there's always an outlier.
So Bill, okay. So let's say you're getting ready for a team. Bill Polian's your advanced scout. He gives you the clear evidence on who you have to stop. So if you can scheme the right way to stop it, how much can defensive scheme make up if, let's just say, admittedly, you have inferior talent in the one-on-one matchups. Their guys are just better than your guys, if not every place, most of the places when you need to execute to stop what they do well. Can you change the scheme to do that, or is that just a fait accompli at that point?
Well, the answer is nuanced. Let's say you're playing Kansas City. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
The first guy you got to stop is Hill. The next guy you got to stop is Kelce, or he might be the first one, actually, when you break all the film down. You got to keep Mahomes in the pocket. That's easier said than done. And you probably say to yourself, if I'm going to get beat, let me get beat by Hilaire. Because you can't stop all of them. If you try to stop everything, you stop nothing.
Right.
So what you try to do, and the numbers tell you that, is take away the most explosive guys. Or if the quarterback has a go-to guy, you take him away. So I would say, Kelce, I'd take Kelce away first before I did anything else. Because he's the go-to guy.
And you do that by you find the one best guy you can put on Kelce? Do you do that by double-teaming Kelce? Do you do that through a scheme that just makes Kelce's routes difficult to run? What do you do to stop Kelce?
Well, I'm not sure there's anybody in the AFC who has a guy who can stop Kelce one-on-one.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd have to double him.
Okay.
You give him a number of different doubles. Zone doubles where you go in and out, or bracket him. Man doubles where you play a guy under him and a guy over him. You give him a number of different looks. But you probably got to double him. I don't think anybody can. There's no linebacker can stay with him one-on-one.
Mm-hmm.
And there aren't many safeties who can.
I mean, that was a fascinating thing in the New England 49ers game over the weekend where, you know, Gilmore was, you know, one-on-one with, you know, George Kittle. I mean, you wonder with Kelce, how much of that, like from an offensive perspective, when you know you're going to get a double team on a weapon like that, and let's not use Kansas City as the example because obviously they have a richness of weapons, but, you know, we could even use the football team as an example where you've got one weapon on offense. But when a defense is trying to scheme away a player, are there things that you can do to try to get that player open?
I mean, sure.
Do you do that through motion?
Yeah.
Can you do that through, you know, certain? How would you attack that when somebody's saying, okay, we're going to take this player away?
The first thing you do is motion, because motion means the defense has to react so that it creates a larger chance for error. Secondly, if somebody's traveling with them, you know it, and you can call routes that will create picks where he can get open. Third, you can formation him where you would put Kelce would be the third wideout detached, let's say a 5-yard split in a 3-by-1 formation. There's two, Hill is on the far outside, somebody's in the slot, and Kelce's detached by about 5 yards from the tackle. Now, what are you going to do over there? Play 4-on-3?
Pick your poison time.
Yeah. 5-on-3? No, you're going to have to zone, because if you play man-to-man, they'll just pick.
Right.
Take your choice, right? Motion into a bunch and pick. So you got to almost zone, which allows him to sit down in a voided area.
Exactly.
So what you're doing is when you zone up off that formation, you're saying, okay, I'm not going to let him get deep. I'm going to give him everything underneath.
Right.
And come up and make the tackle. So you can do it. Number one is motion. Number two is formation. And then number three is if you're audacious enough to try to cover him one-on-one, then single him on the backside of trips. 3x1 make him the guy on the backside of trips. Good luck. You're out there on an island.
Yeah.
So.
Let me ask a generalized question on that. What do you think has caused this, whether you want to call it a resurgence, but all of a sudden, tight ends becoming so important, so many good ones in the league at the same time. Is that some sort of development in athleticism of certain kinds of people? Is that people finally realizing that you could use guys like that as a weapon more? How do you account for the fact that, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, you'd never be able to name this many great tight ends in the league? There's always some, but not like this. Why is this sort of the era of the importance of the tight end?
Well, 53 and a third yards, using 53 and a third yards of the field to begin with. So that creates space for them to operate. Secondly, once that space is created, then the athletic tight end, Dallas Clark, Ingram with the Giants, Kelsey. Mm-hmm. Guy in San Francisco is Ertz, yeah. The guy in San Francisco is Superman. I mean, he's a complete anomaly.
It's George a different Kittle. Deal.
But, yeah, he's on a different planet.
Yes.
But, so, that has created a job. And so, going way back to 15 years ago, 16 years ago, Marcus Pollard was a basketball player.
Yep.
Let's bring him into Indianapolis and make him a tight end.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of Anthony Fasano, of the guy that played in Dallas, who's in Tennessee for so long, the traditional tight end, is that position is almost disappearing.
Right.
Ertz and Goddard are not that. I mean, they're decent enough blockers. Kelsey's a decent enough blocker, but Ingram is not. But even the Giants will tell you Ingram is their best playmaker. And that's what the colleges are using. So guys, now there's a lot of guys who play 3 years of college basketball and they're 6'5", and they don't shoot like 90%, and they're told you're not gonna make it in the NBA. You're too small, right. You don't shoot well enough. They go right to football. And many of them make a living in football. So they're, by definition, they're more athletic.
So it would seem to me, which is one of the reasons I also hate on another level that kids are playing one sport. If you've played basketball, okay, you understand the geometry. When you're boxing a guy out and you're a big tight end, you know how to take that step. So the smaller DB is behind you. You know how to cut the angle down so that you're one step ahead of the other guy, like the way the passing lane would be in basketball. I mean, to me, that would be a wonderful, wonderful way to prepare to be a tight end, is to have played a lot of b-ball.
Yeah, absolutely, sure. That's why they move over.
Hey, Bill, yeah. Why don't you think we haven't seen the emergence of sort of the flip side on defense, where this is not a completely new phenomenon? I mean, you're sort of seeing these guys with these body types, this skill set, that you haven't seen the emergence of someone, imagine like a Sean Taylor at maybe, not 6'2", but maybe 6'4", at like 250, 260, who can run. Why aren't we seeing more guys? I mean, I guess Tremaine Edwards kind of fits that bill, but we're just not seeing as many guys like that on defense who have that build, who have that level of speed and range. I mean, you think about like a Devin White. He's obviously got the speed, doesn't necessarily have the height and the size of some of these tight ends. Why don't you think we've seen the emergence of some of these guys, at least on the collegiate level or even the high school level, be pushed more onto the defensive side of the ball? Because you think there would be a real market for these guys who could cover tight ends.
Well, Simmons, in Phoenix from Clemson, is that guy. He not only can cover tight ends, but he can run with quarterback and tackle a quarterback. The more the colleges recognize that they need that guy, the more we'll get. There are, God only makes so many of them, number one. But number two, the colleges have to recognize that that guy plays a role. I can't pronounce the young man's name at Notre Dame, number six. He's, I don't want to butcher his name. He's that guy, he's probably 225, probably a little bit light, but he's going to be a dynamite safety / linebacker. He can blitz, he can cover, he can tackle, he can run. You're going to see more and more of those players coming into the college game because the college coaches use this 3-3-5 alignment, and they're figuring out that the one of the five should be Superman, and you don't play him back all the time. You play him up in the box, and so you'll see more of those guys. They're coming along.
This is our plea.
Owusu Koramoah, I think, is the name of the player I'm thinking
of. No, it is. And that was a very good pronunciation. I was moments away from butchering it myself. So thank you for taking that off of me. But I mean, I think there is a lesson in this. Like, you see Isaiah Simmons go eighth in this draft. There might be some money, more money potentially in the draft to be made if some of these guys switched over to the defensive side of the ball. Let's do it, guys.
Yeah. Speaking, by the way, of guys you have to stop, Diggs. 70 catches, 12.6 a catch. Kelsey, 58 catches, 12.4. That's a wide receiver's, APC. Waller from 55 catches, 8.6. Now, he doesn't work down the field as well as Kelsey, but he's a big part of their game. Surprisingly, you mentioned this before, Scott, Cooks in Houston is 51 catches, 12.6. I mean, right. That passing game is decent. Everything else, Beasley in Buffalo, 49 catches, 12.1.
Right. So there's one I don't want to miss of keeping us moving along.
Let me just mention this. This is the last one I want to mention.
Okay.
Because it speaks to a myth that's a semi-myth. The guy that takes the top off the defense. He is frightening, and you do have to defense him. There's no two ways about it, whether he has good hands or doesn't have good hands. So the proof of that is in the numbers. And I hate, when I did the numbers, I said, nah, this is not right. And then I went back and did them again, and I said, it's right, and therefore I'm wrong. Hill from Kansas City, 14.2, 48 catches. Will Fuller from Houston, who does not have good hands, 47 catches, 15.8. He's the guy that strikes out a lot, but hits 3-run homers.
Mm-hmm.
He's Stanton. So there is a place for him in the game. There is a place. To take the top off the guy, off the defense guy, even if he's not a consistent catcher, is valuable. Beckham, 43, 13.9. He's not having his best year. But imagine Beckham with only 43 catches. What's going on here?
Right.
Cincinnati, Higgins, 43, 15.2. Now, Higgins is raw, but, I mean, there's a lot to work with there. A lot to work with there. So, the guy who takes the top off, Brown, 47 in Baltimore, 14.5.
Right.
They're valuable.
So it's actually a perfect segue, though, into what I was going to bring up. So chunk plays, explosive plays aside, winning teams have to be able to sustain drives. take us through the third down conversion percentages and tell us, you know, what do you see out of those?
You're looking for 45% here. That's what you, that's where you'd like to be. Houston 41.8. Las Vegas 52.3. So they're doing a nice job. Indy 39.9. Ooh, hold on.
Yeah, yeah.
That shows you that the receivers are you know, there are receivers missing there. Chargers with young Mr. Herbert 45.4. Tennessee, Tannehill 45.4. Kansas City, a whopping 53.2. Thank you, Kelsey. Buffalo 56.1. That's a good number. That's a good number. Miami 40.8. New England 41.7. It hasn't been that long, that low since you know.
Yeah, since Tom.
The Dark Ages.
Since the beginning of time.
Yes. Pittsburgh 46.5. Darn good. Jacksonville, amazingly, 48.4. What Minshew is, and we'll see this, I think, as this at week 12 and then at week 17. What Minshew is, at worst, is a really good backup, a functional backup. I don't know if he's even a good starter, but I know that he's a functional backup. So the numbers tell me that here's a guy we ought to be looking at if we're looking for a real quality backup. And it, because he's playing with a not a good team and doing a nice job. Baltimore, 43.6. Whoops.
Yeah, that's
right?
Beware.
Beware. Beware. Cleveland, with the two backs and Landry and Beckham, 39.9. What is wrong?
Not good.
Man? Go to the film and let's get on the film and find out what the heck's going on. This tells us get into the film immediately.
Yeah. And a legitimate tight end.
And a legitimate receiving tight end, yes. Yes. Denver, 36.1. No thanks.
Mm. Yep.
I understand that. Cincinnati.
Hey, Bill, speaking of which, he has not played well this year, do you think?
No, he hasn't. No, the numbers tell you that he hasn't. No, yeah, that's my point.
Yeah.
Cincinnati, 38. Now, you know, the question with the Jets is there's no receivers, there's no running back. Gore, you know, he's going to be a Hall of Famer, and deservedly so, but he's on the far, he reaches the end of his career. And, you know, and would you be willing to trade for Darnold? The numbers tell you beware.
Uh-uh. Be very aware. I think the bigger question with the Jets is, will Sunshine live in Manhattan or will he live in New Jersey?
Are you offering the over-under on that, Scott?
I'm going to say Trevor Lawrence ends up in Manhattan. That's my hard money guess, but we'll see. We'll see how it shakes out.
All right. You think he's going to buy a bar like Joe Willie?
It's a bad commute.
See, to me, the more interesting question is, A, will he come to New York? And B, you know, what do you do with Darnold? Somebody will take a chance there.
What do you think the market for Sam would be, though? I mean, do you think you could get a one for Sam?
No, I don't think so. The injuries, I think, preclude that.
But we certainly can look some places where you could get something. You know, in the deficiencies we've been pointing at a quarterback around the league, right? I mean, I guess this would be the forget what you trade him for. With a guy in a situation like that, and you've seen what he can do, how is and not Lawrence, but how do you compare a known quantity like that, the good and the bad that he's done in the NFL, versus a guy who is coming out of college, no matter how good, and still never played against NFL talent? How does that sample size, that knowable sample size versus the complete unknown, stack up in your mind if you're rating, what am I going to give up for somebody?
Well, I would argue that his sample size, Darnold's sample size, is small. He was hurt and missed a significant portion of his rookie year.
Okay.
He's been in and out of the lineup because of injuries this year. He's playing behind a patchwork quilt of an offensive line. He has no playmakers around him. That said, he hasn't played well. So what you're doing is taking a chance on a semi-known quantity. The college player coming in is an unknown quantity.
Right.
The pro player like Darnold without a large body of work is a semi-known quantity. So the fact that he's semi-known and also has at least been injured some part of the time would tell you, don't invest a premium pick in this guy. But to use the old Al Davis philosophy, always take a chance on a failed number one. Somebody saw something in him that made them think that he was pretty special. And I think Al was right in that case. And Exhibit A is Jim Plunkett.
Yes.
Who had a large body of not so good work when he left New England. And yep. Al picked him up and you know, did exceptionally well with him.
Yeah, put a good supporting cast around him. I mean, it certainly, Al's philosophy to me would always make more sense than not. You know what I mean? In other words, if you're going to take that risk, that's got to be more than 50-50 that the guy's going to have something, somebody pick. You know, especially as you've talked about, Bill, how especially now with how sophisticated scouting is, for a team to have studied a guy that far and put him as a first rounder, that's not going to be a guy who can't play football.
Well, and you've seen moments with him, though, too. I mean, it's not like, yeah, he's played bad, but I mean, there's been games. I mean, you think about the Monday night game against the Lions. I mean, he's played some games where you wonder, what do you think his life would be like if he was the heir apparent or the next quarterback in New England? You just wonder, in the right system, with his talent, could it work?
Yeah, you wonder that. He's shown flashes.
Yes.
He's shown enough to tease you. But if the three of us were sitting in an office discussing what we would offer for him, you know, I would be the first to say, listen, there's some injuries here. So that's going to knock the price down. He's essentially a failure. They're admitting that. So that's going to knock the price down. And what can we reasonably expect to get from him if he's not different than what we're seeing now? The answer to that question is probably a reasonably good backup.
Yeah, I was going to say.
So what would you pay for a young, reasonably good backup?
So,
well, by the way, you're only going to keep for two more years because you probably, if he was a backup, you wouldn't pick up his fifth-year option, I doubt.
Yeah.
So
would you, at this point, with him being more unknown, go back to your Gardner Minshew comment. If they were both available, and let's just say you could get them both for whatever that same non-dear price is, who would you rather have right now as your backup, Gardner Minshew?
No, I'd rather have Darnold because there's more upside. There's more upside.
Okay. And enough to feel like it's a thing I thought you liked about Minshew was, if you know, when the way backup quarterbacks go in, you know, one of the main things is a steady hand at the tiller. He's not going to lose the game for you, right? Maybe he's not going to be spectacular. Is there an argument for perhaps a more pedestrian, but you know, less mistake-prone guy as your backup?
Yeah, but you know, we're talking here about a guy that it's let's use the pitching analogy. We're talking about a guy with a 90 mile an hour fastball who's got to nibble around the plate. His control has to be great. Everything has to go his way versus a guy with a 95 mile an hour fastball who, if he's on, is going to have a much higher strikeout rate.
Right. And if he's not, he's going to walk and give up home runs. Walks and home runs, but yeah, okay.
Well, I get so, Bill, then I guess the more interesting comparison would be Trubisky or Darnold.
Oh, no, Darnold. Darnold's, Trubisky's proven that.
It's a softball, Bill.
Yeah. Wait, Scott, how can you call that a more interesting comparison than my comparison?
Come on. This is the late in the podcast throwing up softballs just to see who wants to take a swing.
That was not a more interesting comparison. You offered as a comparison.
Do you think Trubisky? Here's the question.
Let me answer the question because there is an answer to it. Darnold still has upside. I'm not sure Trubisky has a lot of upside, but I also think that I would between the two, I would take Darnold because of the upside. And because of the flashes, which Trubisky has not shown in reality, but I would not be adverse to taking Trubisky at the right price and trying to develop him. Because at very best, or at very worst, you're getting, a reasonably good backup who's athletic.
From a GM's perspective, like, is there wild card value in terms of trade value for somebody, like, because the other quarterback you would think in this sort of continuum would obviously be Dwayne Haskins, is there more value in somebody like him just because we've seen such little? I mean, we haven't seen anything. We've seen very little. We've obviously heard, you know, some of the off the field stuff that's been going on, but from a football standpoint, we haven't seen that much. Is that an enticement, you think, potentially to try to get more?
You mean to get more from him, for him?
Well, no, to get more in a trade. So, like, let's say if all three of these guys are being traded, The fact that we just haven't seen Dwayne play that much football, you wonder if that's if you were the GM trading him, can you use that as a lure?
No. That's going to lower the price.
Just thinking like the Josh Rosen context, right? You know, like, because it will be interesting to see if Darnold goes for a, you know, mid to high second rounder the way Josh Rosen did. You know, Rosen, Darnold probably clearly better player than Rosen at this point, has more potential, it would seem, that, you know, Darnold's probably going to go for a similar thing.
That's the argument that the Jets are going to make when in trade talks.
Yeah.
This guy's a better prospect right now than Rosen, and Rosen went for this.
Right.
You know, whether anybody's buying at that price remains to be seen.
Yeah, and of course, some of that, just like anything in capitalism, is going to come down to the marketplace right at that moment in time. How many people need a backup quarterback? I mean, right? Because, so, you know, sometimes the same player at the same position has more market value, you know, than not, supply and demand.
Well, and also, to that point, I mean, but when looking at the draft, I mean, this is going to be one of the more complicated drafts in terms of the quarterback evaluation process once you get past Lawrence. I mean, you're going to get to see Fields for another 8-game sample. But, like, you know, looking at the kid in North Dakota, I mean, you're not going to have seen him play a ton of football where he's probably a top 10 pick. Whereas you've seen Sam play a ton of football. And you wonder, you know, right scheme, right system, you know, does that work in Scott Turner's offense?
Well, take the North Dakota kid out of the equation, because judging college quarterbacks is a crapshoot, and they're all overdrafted. You know, look at the guys we're talking about, Trubisky, way overdrafted. And by the way, it's not the Bears' fault. They knew where he was going to go. If they wanted him, they had to go up and take him. I don't fault them for that. I applauded them on draft day for doing it. They're just overdrafted, that's all. So when you're talking about guys that are in the league at the moment, that's one thing. When you talk about guys coming out, I mean, that's truly a crapshoot.
Yeah.
And I mean, I wouldn't take Trevor Lawrence without doing a lot of homework. I want to see every throw. And then I want to go back and watch Ohio State and, you know, watch the playoff games and you know, see all of what goes into it. I mean, I wouldn't anoint him at this point in time because you just haven't done enough work.
Right. And then with the kid from North Dakota, I mean, you got to take into account the level of play. I mean,
well, Carson, I mean, people talk about level of play, but you'll find that out at the Senior Bowl. That's how that's how Steve McNair answered the question. It's how Carson Wentz answered the question. If he does it at the Senior Bowl, you don't have any worries there. Now you're going to have to go off the junior film or sophomore film, as the case may be. But, you know, you can see enough.
Okay.
All right, any other key AFC stats we want to hit before we throw it into the audible?
No, we'll save the kicking game for next time around.
All right. Okay.
Yeah, because I have lots of Stephen Gostkowski questions.
so does Stephen Gostkowski.
Yeah, it's just like golf. It's just great. I mean, we're going through it with Washington. I mean, Dustin was aces, and something's wacky in the swing. It doesn't make sense.
That's right. I had the discussion, Gostkowski or Vinatieri, and we took Vinatieri. And it turned out right for both teams.
I think that's going to work out right in the end for everybody, but I think only one's probably a Hall of Famer. All right. Well, thank you so much for doing this today, Bill. It was truly super, super duper fun. Well, with that, Rick, I know you have a audible question that has been the NFL TV producer sort of dream for the last 2 weeks. Why don't you dive into it?
Okay. So, Bill, we've touched on this, but I want to use it not just in this specific example, but to talk more broadly about it. Let's talk about the benching of Fitzmagic for Tua. Okay. Now, back in the real day when I was growing up, you know, got for the most part good. No matter how good quarterbacks got drafted, you know, they sat on the bench and they did an apprenticeship and they watched for a year or years to hone their skills. And then they got their post-grad degree that way and they felt qualified. Now, I don't know whether, you know, it's the money that first-round quarterbacks are getting, even still under the cap. I don't know if it's with the media explosion, pressure from fans and, other folks from the monetary side of things. But, and I know, obviously, with Peyton, but that was a generational talent that you did it with. I mean, if you were going to say what would be the best way generally to develop on the long term and nurture a quarterback, a very good quarterback, maybe not the number one in the draft, but a very good, a first round quality quarterback, is it when do you throw him into the field of fire and when do you try and give him the benefit of things like Aaron Rodgers had, where you know you can watch somebody or handsome Jimmy had, and which obviously helped them in their development because they were behind big stars. But what's really the best way to do this?
It depends entirely on your situation, and it depends entirely on who the quarterback is. So let's take two extremes. Peyton Manning played 4 years of college football at the very highest level. Very smart. The son of a quarterback. Not only pedigree, but a gym rat. Understood the game inside and out. Had a sound background and a sound understanding of the game. Was physically mature. 22 years old coming in. Emotionally and mentally mature. And so, you say to yourself, okay, we're getting a guy that has the tools, we think, and we're going to have to nurture him. But what's the best way to nurture him?
Right.
And then the next level you reach is, next plateau you reach is to say, who's in front of him? Is the guy in front of him anywhere near capable of doing what he can do? The answer was no. So you say, okay, he's mature, he's played 4 years of college football, he can handle the pressure, let's put him in there, let him make all the mistakes. I forgot another, I'm sorry, another issue. What's surrounding him?
Yes.
We had a left tackle in Tarik Glenn. We had Marvin Harrison. We had Ken Dulger. We had Marshall Faulk, et cetera. So he had a pretty good cast around him.
Mm-hmm.
And so you say to yourself, it's going to be a rocky ride. It's going to take 4 years because it takes 4 years with everyone. And so we'll speed the process up by putting him in there. And he really can't be any worse than what we were going to play with anyway. Here's why it takes 4 years. The first year, he has to learn to drive to the facility, find the lunchroom, operate the projector, right, find out where the meeting rooms are, get to know his coaches, and get to see what it's like playing against grown men in the National Football League. Mm-hmm. You hope by the end of the year, he can get you in and out of the huddle. He can call the plays. He's not physically or mentally cowed by the challenge. And that by the end of the year, even though statistics will be awful, you can see the arrow going up. That's what you want out of the first year. Mm-hmm. The biggest jump he makes is between the first and second year in the off-season program, where he learns what defense is all about, where he learns to figure out what personnel groupings and what people he has to be careful of, what people he can pick on, etc., etc. He now has a full grasp of the offense. He's had an off-season and a training camp to work with the guys that he's going to work with. And so you hope by the end of the second year that he's got a grasp of the offense, that he can call the plays, that he knows who his guys are, he knows what the defenses are, and he can manage a game in a way that looks professional. The third year, he learns his craft in toto. He learns what he has to do to win in the National Football League against virtually every opponent, because they're all different. And he's gone through the ups and downs of years one and two, and he himself is developing a personality and a grasp of what he can do, as opposed to, oops, what are they doing? And then in the fourth year, he's the finished product. Now he's learned his own personnel. He's learned the game. He's learned how to prepare. And he's learning to manipulate the defense. That's the finished product. And mm-hmm. I've seen very few exceed that timeline. Very few.
Right.
Let's take the other side of the coin.
Can I ask you one thing about Peyton before you move on? So, but in Peyton, physical talent aside, it seems to me that there were two unusual things there. One was, as you talked about, his heritage, his depth of knowledge, his maturity, his leadership at a young age, and the fact that you did have a good supporting cast around him, not just in terms of alternatives, you know, who could catch the ball, you could hand the ball to, but an offensive line that can protect him. I mean, most of the time, the first quarterback in the draft is going to a terrible team. If you don't have those special things that Peyton had, and I guess that's where you're going to take me now, because I know some of it is who's ahead of you. But that aside, I mean, if a Peyton Manning, even as much as he had with those things, had gone to a lousy team with a lousy offensive line, I mean, could he make that progression, or is he going to become so battered and so psychologically scarred in getting there that it stunts his growth?
Well, that's the question you ask when you determine whether or not you're going to put him in there. Is our offensive line good enough? Are the people surrounding him good enough? Can we put him out there and not worry about whether or not we can protect him or he can protect himself? That's part of the process when you decide whether you're going to put him in. You've decided that you're going to draft him. Now the question is, are you going to put him in? So that's part of the equation. The other side of the coin is Trubisky played 1 year of college football in an offense that didn't have any relation to what he was going to do in the NFL. And even there, he struggled at times. Yes, he had a big arm. Yes, he was very athletic. Yes, he made some wow plays, particularly when he was running the ball. But he also made a ton of errors. He made, you know, more bad throws than you like. His judgment wasn't the best. He looked like a green, undeveloped quarterback. So no matter where you draft him, in my view, I would be the hard guy in the building. And I would walk out on draft day and say hello to him today, watch him at minicamp, and then you're not going to see him for another year. Mm-hmm. That's it. I don't care whether you like it or you don't like it. Our job is to utilize this player in the best way to help our team. And the best way to help our team and to help him is to have him sit for a year and learn the game. We think he's a talent. We think he can win. You know? And so that's the way I would have handled it. I'm not second-guessing the Bears. As I say, I applauded them for making the pick. But there were reasons to say, no, he's not going to play. He's not ready. The young man from Oregon in San Diego, San Diego's general manager, who's a close friend, said, I don't know if he's ready. I we're better off to have him sit at least for half the season. Okay. He was in Carolina with us. He saw what we did with Kerry Collins. Mm-hmm. Kerry sat for about half the season. Now he went in and did fine. You know, he was green. It was tough. He had his bumps in the road. But in the long run, he did fine. Herbert had to get in there earlier because of the injury to Tyrod. But he, too, had played 4 years of college football. Mm-hmm. The thing to remember about this is eliminate the noise. Just use Herbert as an example. Oh, he's played 4 years. He's at his ceiling. He's not going to get any better. He's not as good as this guy or not as good as... Nonsense. That's pure nonsense. It's just hot air. And as I used to tell the people on our staff, we don't want hot air in here. We want facts. Mm-hmm. Put on the film. Is he ready? Does he look like a mature quarterback? Is he physically ready to withstand the beating of the National Football League? Or is he a guy that's going to need a lot of development? And let's go through and make the right decision for the player, because that will be ultimately the right decision for our team. And no amateurs need apply. We don't need amateurs. I would always say this to our staff. We're professionals, right? We've spent our lives in this business. We do, you know, airline pilots don't say, hey, you in the third row, you're a newspaper guy? Well, come up here and land the plane.
Let me give it a rip.
Yeah.
Hey, unless Marty Herney's on the plane, and then they'll be like, hey, let's give it a try.
Scott, five people in the audience got that joke. That's all right.
Everybody got that joke. It's a great joke. Hey, with the Fitzy thing, how much of it do you think it is that they're afraid? I mean, because we've seen this before. He gets so hot and is so streaky that they maybe want to avoid, like, you know, the Pittsburgh game after Fitzmagic. They've seen Tua in practice, and they go, this gives us the best chance to win. Or how much do you think this is coming from something outside of the coaching staff?
I don't with Chan Gailey and the coach down there, I think this is a decision that they made. Let's get him in there. He's ready. Let's get him in there. Let's find, let him get his feet wet. We know we can always go to Fitz if it doesn't work out. Fitz is the ultimate insurance policy because he's the ultimate teammate. He's the ultimate team guy. He's a good player. Let's get him in here and see what we got.
Sure.
And they feel that he's physically ready and mentally ready to play. We'll find out.
This time he's such a great teammate and he's so supportive always of this. You really could feel his heartbreak on this one though. I mean, he really did open up. And that, you know, I mean, this had to be, you know, first of all, where he is in his own career, you know, with the way they were going, how he had played this time. That must really be tough to say, okay, here you go. You've never driven the car. Here are the keys.
Well, you know, that's the business.
I know.
The business we're in.
Yeah.
That's why we all get paid to make decisions.
Do you think they had made that decision given the bye week before this started? Because I certainly couldn't see any. I mean, I get your theory, Scott, but I couldn't see anything on field why they would pull Fitz at this point in time.
I mean, what you'd heard Coach Flores say was that in interviews was that the plan all along was to get Tua in after the bye. And I think, you know, as COVID has screwed up everything in 2020, they just pushed it earlier.
Right. So I was just asking that, you know, is that the cover story or is that the case? I mean, but it does make sense because I just don't see why else they would have done this.
Well, it makes perfect sense. And
I'm being an emotional guy about this. So.
Yeah,
it's totally good.
Right.
You're very swayed by the interview.
That's why I don't have a job in the National Football League. So go ahead.
All right. Well, hey, why don't we end on this one? We got a great fan question for today, and I think with all the Jets talk, it makes complete sense. Not knowing if we were going to get to the Jets, I thought this would be a good one to end on. So the fan question this week comes at what point in a struggling season does an organization call the season a bust and start focusing on next year? And with that thought, we know that everyone says it, but is there a degree of tanking that comes with that decision?
Well, first of all, it's a good question because of what the Browns did. Prior to them, and this is not the regime that's there now, it's a previous regime. And prior to the Philadelphia 76ers, and the Houston Astros, tanking was something that was frowned upon mightily. Players hate it because they all want to win. Coaches hate it because it obviously means that their jobs are on the line, and that's almost always the case. And GMs don't like it because when you tank, you lose. And when you lose, bad things happen. And even if you're willing to withstand that gaffe as a GM or as a head coach, you're not building what Billy Parcells used to call a winning culture. You're building a losing culture, which is waiting for that shining star on the horizon to come in and save everyone. And the shining star may be nothing when it's all said and done. Tua came perhaps a couple of millimeters from having his career ended. So tanking for Tua, which the fans and the media ginned up would have turned out to be an abject failure. So, and that's particularly true in a game like football, where the injury rate is 100%. So, I would have a very difficult time doing that, and didn't in Indianapolis. Didn't. Because we knew Peyton Manning was coming back. And if we were fortunate enough to be bad enough that we got a chance at luck, then we cross that bridge when we come to it. Mm-hmm. But I didn't, the coaches didn't, the players didn't want to do that. We would give our best every week. And I've said on numerous occasions, I never felt prouder of any team that I've been with than I did of our last team in Indianapolis, who knocked Houston out of the top spot in the playoffs. 0-14 or 0-13, we go into the last 3 weeks of the season, win two out of the last three, and knock Houston out of the playoffs, or out of the top seed. So our guys never quit, and that's something to be proud of. So I'm not a fan of tanking, and in the end, I don't know how it works out in the long run. I mean, I don't wish Baker Mayfield any ill, but to pass on Carson Wentz, no thank you.
Yeah. Let that be a lesson, fans. On this podcast, there is no sucking for luck.
Exactly.
We don't do that.
Actually, the phrase annoyed the living daylights out of me.
No,
and
I know.
I will, and fans, just know, we have never tanked a podcast.
Ever. It's never going to happen. All right, Gang. Well, that was a fun one today. Bill, thank you. Know you had a super long day today. Thank you so much for doing this. This was a truly fun one. And then next week, we're going to dive into the wild world of the National Football Conference. I will be on my best behavior to not make every question about the Washington football team. as always, if you have questions, and if you have Washington football team questions, feel free to hit us up on IFBillPolian at Twitter. We'll be sure to get to them. I know a bunch of you have stuff in the hopper, so we'll be sure. I know I promised we would hit you up in this week and next. So we'll be sure to get you in next week's Audible, and we should be good to go. Thank you, guys.
Hey, if you want to come up with a name for the damn team, tell us that, too.
Yeah, we're ready in 2022. We're not going to be ready next season. We're punting on 2021 as well.
All right.
All right, guys. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, guys. Stay safe, everybody. Talk to you next week.
Thank you very much. Stay safe.